I sprawled across it, barely hanging on, and it carried me towards the loading docks at the rear. Somewhere behind me, there was a deafening crash. I guessed that another two big cruisers had collided, but I had no time to turn and look. A catamaran I had unleashed appeared at right angles out of the gloom, coming straight at me. Its steel bow, reinforced for ocean-going journeys, would slice the Riva in half, but there was nothing I could do except hang on. If I abandoned ship, I would end up as a pile of broken bones next to the kindling 50 feet below. I braced myself for the impact, but at the last moment the Riva pulled ahead, and I watched as the big cat passed behind, stripping the paint off the hull right next to me. Light split the darkness, and I looked down and saw that the cops had wheeled in banks of work lights from the yard outside. My first inclination was to shoot them out, but on quick reflection, I decided it would almost certainly give away my position. Instead, I had to watch as they tilted them up and started searching the grid and the rampaging boats for any sign of me. Every second, the Riva carried me closer to the loading bays, but the cops on the lights were working methodically, lighting up sectors, and it was only a matter of moments before they would hit on the old boat and see me. I slid over the side, dangled for a moment, and scanned the area beneath me for any cops. I registered it as clear, but in the confusion and urgency, I was wrong. A cop in a sharkskin suit was running in a cable for more work lights. Hanging over the side of the Riva, clinging by my fingertips, I waited, and let go. I fell 20 feet and almost ripped my arms out of my sockets as I grabbed hold of a horizontal pipe that fed water to the sprinkler system. I had no time to scream. Hand over hand, I moved along the pipe until I could drop down onto the roof of a storeroom. From there, I reached the side wall, and while a dozen cops were climbing higher to find me, I scrambled from one handhold to another down the aluminum siding. Still holding the remote device, I hit the ground while the cops on the work light swept the rafters and boats above. I sprinted for the rear and rounded a corner. There was the loading dock, 30 feet ahead. Cops entering to search the joint had left one of the roller doors up, and I knew that the scooter was only 20 yards away, hidden in the darkness behind the row of garbage skips. Running fast, I caught a flash of movement to my left. I wheeled, the Walther rising fast to the firing position, but saw that it was only a street dog that had wandered in looking for food. The dog wasn't the problem, though. It was the voice that suddenly barked a command from behind me. It was in Turkish, but in some situations all languages are the same. "Drop the gun, raise your hands," was what he was saying, or a pretty fair approximation of it. I guess the guy was armed, and that meant he had me square in the back from what seemed, according to the position of his voice, to be about 10 yards away. "Well done, Turkish cop. Too far for me to jump you, too close for you to miss." I dropped the Walther, but kept the remote. The cop said something, and I guessed from the tone he was telling me to turn around. I wheeled slowly until I faced him. It was the cop in the sharkskin suit, kneeling down, still crouching to connect a cable to the work lights. He had a nasty little Glock pointed at my chest. But that wasn't the most surprising thing. That was reserved for his name. It was SpongeBob. He looked at my face, more surprised than I was.
"Senny,"
he said, and then repeated it in English.
"You."
As the full implication of the deep shit in which I found myself hit him, he curled his lip and smiled with pleasure. I said earlier I had made an enemy for life, and I wasn't wrong. For him, this was payback with a lovely twist. I saw that, behind him, the cigarette had reached the end of the grid and was coming back fast towards us. SpongeBob, still triumphant, yelled over his shoulder into the cavernous space to come quick. Thankfully, I didn't hear my name mentioned, and I figured that he was keeping that as a big surprise. The cigarette came closer, closer. I heard boots running, approaching fast. The cigarette loomed directly above SpongeBob, and I only had a second to act before everything about the mission fell to ruins. I pressed the yellow button. SpongeBob heard the rattle of chains and flashed a glance upwards. The claws holding the huge boat released. He was too alarmed even to scream. Instead, he tried to run. He was no athlete, though, and the sharkskin suit was cut too tight to let him do much more than a strange sidestep. The rear of the hull, housing the twin turbines and all the weight, fell first. It plunged down and took him on the skull, compressing his head into his chest, exploding his neck, and killing him before he even hit the floor. As his body found the concrete, I was already diving behind a mobile crane. The cigarette hit the floor and exploded into fragments of fiberglass and metal. While the steel of the crane protected me from most of the debris, I still felt a stinging pain in my left calf. I ignored it, got to my feet, and ran hard for the little I could see of the roller door through the clouds of dust and swirling debris. I heard the cops yelling, and I guessed they were telling each other to take cover in case more boats started raining down. I saw the open roller door, made it through, and burst out into the night. I sprinted for the garbage skips, saw the Vespa, and was thankful I had exercised the foresight to leave the key in the ignition. My hands were shaking so much, it probably would have taken me 5 minutes to fit it in. The engine burst to life. I roared out from behind the garbage skip, hurtled between a stack of shipping containers, and fishtailed down the road and into the night before the first of the cops had made their way out of the warehouse. My only concern was the chopper, but I saw no sign of it, and guessed that, once the police chief thought I was cornered, he had dismissed it. Whatever the reason, driving more soberly once I hit the busier streets, I reached the hotel without trouble and slid the scooter into the small garage reserved for the manager's old Mercedes. I didn't even notice that I was wounded. Chapter 57. The manager did. He was alone in the foyer, sitting behind a desk on one side of the reception area, when he looked up and saw me enter. As usual, hand extended, his face alight with his signature smile, he came forward to greet me.
Mr. Brody, David Wilson, you have been on the relax with a dinner of the fine quality, I hope.
Before I could answer, I saw his expression change. A shadow of concern and perplexity crossed his face.
But you are wearing an injury of seriousness, he said, pointing across his always impeccably clean tile floor to where smears of blood marked my path.
I looked down, saw a tear on the left calf of my chinos, and figured that the piece of flying debris from the exploding cigarette had done more damage than I had realized. The blood had flowed down onto the sole of my trainers, and I had now traipsed it across the hotel foyer.
Damn, I said.
I crossed the main road down near the BP gas station. There's a rusty railing they use as a road divider. I guess I didn't climb it as well as I thought. It wasn't a great explanation, but it was the best I could do at short notice, and the manager seemed to accept it without question.
Yes, I know this place, he said. The traffic is of much madness. Here, let me be of helping.
But I declined, insisting instead on making my way to my room, walking on the tip of my foot to prevent leaving any more bloody smears on his floor. Once inside, with my door locked, I took off my trousers and, utilizing a pair of travel tweezers, succeeded in pulling a jagged hunk of metal out of my calf. Once it was removed, the wound started to bleed like a mother, but I had already torn a t-shirt into strips, and I got it compressed and bandaged in a few seconds. Only then did I open my shirt and turn my attention to the photo I had stolen from the wedding album. It showed Kumali and her then-husband, smiling, arm in arm, leaving the reception for their honeymoon. He was a handsome guy, in his late 20s, but there was something about him. The cut of his linen pants, the aviator sunglasses dangling from his hand, that made me think he was a player. There was no way I could imagine him being a stalwart of the local mosque, and once again, looking at Kumali's beautiful face, I encountered the same damn circle I couldn't square. I turned the photo over and saw that Turkish photographers were no different from their counterparts elsewhere. On the back was the name of the photographer, a serial code, and a phone number in Istanbul to call for reprints. It was too late to phone him, so, with my calf throbbing hard, I opened my laptop to check for messages. I was surprised to see that there was no information from Bradley about Kumali's background, and I was in the middle of cursing Whisperer and the researchers at the CIA when I saw a text message from Apple telling me how much I had been charged for my latest music download. I opened iTunes and saw I was the proud owner of Turkey's Greatest Hits, a compilation of the country's recent entries in the Eurovision Song Contest.
Oh, Jesus.
I had to endure two tracks and part of a third before I found, embedded in it, a series of text documents. Although it didn't say so, it was clear that the researchers had hacked into the Turkish police database and found Kumali's human resources file. Their report said that she had studied 2 years of law, dropped out, applied to the National Police Academy, and undertaken a 4-year degree course. In the top tier of her graduating class, she had been streamed into criminal investigation, and, after service in Ankara and Istanbul, her knowledge of English meant that she was posted to a tourist destination where it would be put to best use. Bodrum. They found plenty of other stuff, commendations and promotions mainly. She was a good officer by the look of it. But it was all standard career stuff, and it was clear that, even from her time at the academy, the Turkish police had known her as Kumali and nothing else. The researchers at Langley had also wondered if that was her real surname, and they tried to find an electronic back door to access marriage licenses, birth certificates, or passport applications, but they ran straight into a brick wall. Amazingly, Turkish public records couldn't be hacked. It wasn't because the government had adopted, like the Pentagon, some complex system of cybersecurity. The answer was much simpler. None of the archives had been digitized. The official records existed only on paper, probably bundled up, tied with ribbon, and stored in endless warehouses. According to Langley, the only way to access anything more than 5 years old was by a written application, a process which could take over a month. I stared at the report in frustration. As was so often the case with the agency's research, it was all tip, no iceberg. I figured that sooner or later they would resolve the question of her name, but as the lawyers say, time was of the essence. Pissed off with their work, I went to bed. Thanks to Langley, the entire investigation now rested on a photographer in Istanbul I had never heard of and who might well have been retired or dead. Chapter 58. He was neither, although by the sound of his cough and the lighter firing up a constant stream of cigarettes, the dead part might have been closer than he wished. I had woken before dawn, dragged my injured leg to the laptop, put the USB travel drive into a slot, and started to work through Kumali's files. It would have been slow and grinding work, except that most of it was in Turkish, and I had no choice but to discount the vast majority of them. Even so, you get a sense of things, and I couldn't claim that among the letters and work files I found anything that raised my suspicions. The mistake that most people make when they want to stop someone from seeing material is to encrypt it, which means that a person like me knows exactly where to look. As I had suspected when I was in her living room, nothing was coded, and if she had been smart enough to hide any incriminating files in plain sight, I was damned if I could identify them. Nor was there anything in Arabic, even though we had good reason to suspect she knew the language. Having drawn a blank with the files, I turned to her emails. Thankfully, many of them were in English, and I saw that she had a wide circle of friends and acquaintances, many of them other mothers with Down syndrome children. Among the hundreds of messages, I found only two that made me stop. They were both from a Palestinian charity associated with the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, a group that frequently organized suicide bombings against Israelis. The emails acknowledged donations to an orphanage in the Gaza Strip, and my first reaction was to ask why, if Kumali really wanted to help kids, she didn't give to UNICEF. On the other hand, charity was one of the five pillars of Islam, and if it was a crime to donate money to organizations associated with radical groups, we would end up indicting half the Muslim world. More, probably. I marked the two emails with a red flag, then put the USB drive into an envelope and addressed it to Bradley in New York. As soon as FedEx opened, I would courier it to him to be on past a Whisperer for further analysis. I looked at the clock. It was 7 a.m., and though it was early, I wanted to find out whether the photographer was dead or alive. I called the number, waited for what seemed minutes, and was about to give up and try later when I heard an irritable voice give a greeting in Turkish. I apologized for speaking English, talking slowly in the hope that he could follow me.
"Can you speak a bit faster? I'm falling back asleep here," he said,
in an accent that indicated he had watched a few too many westerns. Pleased that we could at least communicate, I asked him if he was a photographer, and when he confirmed it, I said that I was planning a special gift for the wedding anniversary of two friends. I wanted to put together a photo collage of their big day and needed to buy a number of reprints.
"Have you got the code number?"
he asked, more polite now that there was money to be made. "Sure," I replied, and read off the number on the back of the stolen glossy. He asked me to wait while he checked his files, and a minute or two later, he returned and told me there was no difficulty. He had the file in front of him. "Just to make sure there's no confusion," I said, "can you confirm the names of the bride and groom?"
"No problemo, partner. The groom is Ali Riza Kumali."
He went on to give an address, but I wasn't interested. The moment I heard it, I knew for sure that the cop hadn't reverted to her previous surname. "And the bride?" I asked, trying to keep the excitement out of my voice. "Have you got a name for her?"
"Sure," he replied. "Leila Al-Nasuri. Is that the couple?"
"Yeah, that's them, Sheriff,"
he laughed. "I've never been quite sure how to spell her unmarried name," I continued. "Can you give it to me?" He did. I thanked him for his help, told him that I would be in touch as soon as I had a full list of the photos I needed, and hung up. The name Al-Nasuri wasn't Turkish. It was straight out of Yemen or Saudi or the Gulf States. Wherever it was Arabic. And so was the man in the Hindu Kush. I grabbed my passport, headed out the door, and almost ran to the elevator. Chapter 59. The door slid open, and although it was only 7:20 in the morning, I stepped out into what appeared to be some sort of celebration. The manager, the receptionist, the bellhop, and other hotel staff were gathered at the front desk and had been joined by several of the carpenters and other friends of the manager who had helped me with the mirrors. The conversation, all in Turkish, was highly animated, and coffee and pastries were being handed around. Despite the hour, somebody had produced a bottle of raki, and I wondered if they had won the lottery or something. The manager approached me, smiling even more widely than normal, waving a copy of that morning's local newspaper.
"We have news of the greatest happiness," he said. "You recall the SpongeBob, the man of the biggest corruption, a curse on all citizens of goodness."
"Yeah, I remember. Why?"
"He is dead."
"Dead?" I said, faking surprise and taking the copy of the newspaper and looking at an exterior photograph of the marina warehouse with cops everywhere. "It's hard to believe," I said. "How?"
"Squashed, flat like the cake of a pan," he explained. "Some man of idiot brain broke into the house belonging to a cop of the female."
"Broke into a cop's house? Yeah, what an idiot brain."
"Probably a Greek people," he said,
absolutely serious. "When did this happen?" I asked, trying to act normal, just kicking it along. Everybody else was standing near the desk, and the manager and I were in our own private world.
"Last of the evening, while you were having your relax with the dinner of the fine quality, just before you walk in with your bloody..."
He paused, as a thought occurred to him, and though he tried to hold the sentence back, he couldn't.
"They say the killer ran from the boat place with a trail of the blood injury," he said.
He stopped and looked at me. Our eyes met and held. There was no doubt he knew who the killer was. I could have denied it, but I didn't think it would have been convincing. Or perhaps I could have issued some dark threat, but I was certain he wasn't easily intimidated. I didn't like it, but I figured I had to trust my intuition and take a chance on him and his friendship. "No, no," I said finally. "You're of the wrongness quite substantial. My relax at the fine food wasn't last night. That was the night before." He looked at me in confusion, about to argue, thinking I was genuinely mistaken, but I kept talking so that he didn't have a chance to blunder on. "Last night you and I were here, in the lounge," I said. "You remember? It was quiet. There was nobody else around." Suddenly his eyes sparked as understanding dawned.
"Oh yes," he said. "Of course, that's right. The dinner was of the night previous."
"Now you remember. Last night, you and I talked. You were explaining to me about the Greeks. It was a long conversation.
Oh, yes, one of the longest. Those damn Greek peoples. Nothing is simple with them.
True. You had a lot of things, a lot of history you had to tell me. It was well past 10 p.m. when I went to bed.
Later, probably 11 p.m. is more the time of my memory,
he said, with great enthusiasm. Yes, I think you're right, I responded. We looked at each other again, and I knew my intuition about him had been right. The secret was safe. He indicated the passport in my hand and dropped his voice.
Are you leaving in the hurry not to return?
He asked. No, no, I said. If anybody asks, I've gone to Bulgaria. I spoke about finding an important witness. I farewelled him and headed for the front door and my car. I opened the trunk, pulled out the rubber lining, and found a way to access the right rear wheel arch. I removed the tracking transmitter held in place by strips of magnets and attached it low down on the pole of a parking sign. With any luck, no pedestrian would see it, and whoever was monitoring it at MIT would think my car was still parked at the curb. I got behind the wheel and drove for the border. Chapter 60. All day I hammered the Fiat down endless stretches of highway, stopping only for gas, passing the distant minarets of Istanbul in the afternoon, and reaching the Bulgarian frontier in the early evening. The hardscrabble corner of the world where Turkey, Greece, and Bulgaria meet is one of the busiest road junctions in Europe, and once I had left Turkey and entered a sort of no-man's land, I was surrounded by long-haul semis crawling towards Bulgarian immigration and customs. About 40 minutes and about 100 yards progress, I called out to the driver of a Danish freighter stopped on the side of the road and asked him how long he figured it would take to clear the frontier.
About 8 hours from here, he replied. Depends on how many illegal immigrants they find and have to process.
Bulgaria had somehow managed to become part of the European Union and had quickly established itself as the organization's most vulnerable border, acting as a magnet for anyone who wanted to enter the Union illegally and travel on to other, richer pastures like Germany and France. By the look of the trucks and people movers, there was no shortage of chancers and people smugglers. I thought about trying to get to the front and showing my shield, but rejected it. There was always a chance I'd meet some thickhead who was only too happy to show the FBI who was boss. Instead, I undertook some brief preparations, pulled onto the shoulder, and drove up the inside of the endless queue. I passed under two overhead structures with cameras and signs, and figured that pretty soon the border patrol would come and find me. 2 minutes later, silhouetted against the twilight, I saw blue flashing lights as a car approached fast down the dirt shoulder towards me. It stopped about 10 yards in front, blocking my path, and the guy riding shotgun, probably the more senior of the two, lumbered out and walked towards me. He was about my age, overweight, and his uniform looked as if an even bigger man had been sleeping in it. You could tell he was ready to start yelling and order me back to the end of the queue. I had about 10 words of Bulgarian, gleaned from a visit years ago, and luckily they included, "I am sorry." I got it out fast, before he could launch, and I saw that the phrase at least drew some of the venom from his snarling face. I couldn't tell from his eyes, because despite the hour, he was wearing shades. I kept talking, switching to English, throwing in the Bulgarian apology a few more times. I told him that I had been in his fine country before, and had always been overwhelmed by the friendliness of the people. I was hoping that would be the case again now that I needed assistance. I was running late and was desperately trying to catch a flight out of Sofia, the Bulgarian capital. He grunted and looked as if he were about to tell me he didn't give a shit. Like I said, they were a friendly people. When he saw that I was handing him my passport, he looked at me quizzically. I met his gaze and he took the book. He opened it at the details page and found the 500 lev in banknotes, about 300 U.S., a month's wages that far east, that I had put in there. I had arrived at what was always the most dangerous part of any such transaction. Paying off an official was a serious offense in any jurisdiction, and it was at that stage the guy in uniform could really shake you down if he wanted to. 500 to go to the front of the queue? Try 20,000, and your watch and camera, please, not to charge you with attempted bribery. He asked for my driver's license, and with that and the passport, he returned to his squad car. Vehicles that I had overtaken on the inside were now crawling past, hitting their horns in celebration of excellent Bulgarian justice and giving a thumbs up to the two officers. I wasn't angry. In their position, I probably would have felt the same. The man returned and told me to open the driver's door. It looked like the real shakedown was on the way, and I was bracing myself, about to reach for my shield, when he climbed onto the door sill so that he was standing up next to me, holding the door half closed.
"Drive," he said, "and hit the horn."
I did as I was told, and he started signaling to several of the big semis to stop immediately, opening up a gap.
"Go between them," he ordered,
and to the accompaniment of huge air brakes hissing, I squeezed into a lane in the middle of the road, which half a dozen languages said was for official use only.
"Faster,"
the officer ordered. I needed no further encouragement and floored it. Followed by the squad car with its lights flashing and the officer still hanging onto the open door, we flew past the miles of semis and coaches until we reached a row of glass booths topped by various crests and a huge Bulgarian flag. The guy clinging to the door took my passport, stepped into one of the booths, borrowed a seal from his colleague, and stamped my passport. He returned, handed me the book, and I figured was about to tell me his colleague also needed a contribution, but I was already hitting the gas and heading into the night before he opened his mouth. I traveled fast, headlights stabbing into the darkness, revealing acres of forest and, as if life in the new EU wasn't surreal enough, clutches of women in micro miniskirts and skyscraper heels standing on the roadside in the middle of nowhere. Major trucking routes in other countries had endless billboards. In Eastern Europe, they featured prostitutes, and no country more so than Bulgaria. I passed hundreds of them, gypsy girls mostly, waif-like figures in lingerie and fake fur, hard-eyed kids whose lives revolved around the cabin of a semi or the back seat of a car. If they were pregnant, their services sold for a premium, and you didn't have to be a genius to work out that orphans were one of the country's only growth industries.
"Paramos,"
I said to myself as I drove on, recalling the Romani word that Bill had told me so many years ago. I was looking at just another form of the devouring. At last, the young women gave way to gas stations and fast food outlets, and I entered the town of Svilengrad, an outpost of about 20,000 people who had virtually nothing to recommend it except a pedestrianized main street and a wide range of shops that stayed open until well past midnight to cater to the endless stream of truckers. I parked the car far away and found four of the stores I was looking for clustered together. I chose the most down-at-heel of them, the one that, as far as I could tell, had no video recording equipment or surveillance cameras. Inside, I bought the two items that had led me to drive 700 miles in 12 hours and had taken me from the edge of Asia into the old Soviet bloc. A piece of junk cell phone and a prepaid anonymous SIM card. I returned to my car, and under a single street lamp in a dark corner of a Bulgarian town nobody had ever heard of, surrounded by farmland and young gypsy hookers, I made a call to a number with an area code, which didn't exist. Chapter 61. Using an untraceable cell phone routed through the Bulgarian phone system, and fairly confident that MIT would not be listening, I waited to talk to Whisperer directly. I had to tell him Leyla Kumali's real name. I had to report that she was an Arab, and I had to reveal that she was the woman in the phone box. That was the first imperative of any agent who was still alive and far from home, to pass on what they had learned. It was the only insurance against apprehension or death, and they taught you from the earliest days that information didn't exist until it had been safely transmitted. But more than that, I had to discuss with him the problem of rendition and torture. The phone rang five times before I heard Whisperer's voice.
"Who is it?"
he asked. It was early afternoon in Washington, and I was shocked at how weary he sounded. "Dave, it's me," I replied, deliberately using his little-known first name, just in case somebody was listening, keeping the tone light and unhurried despite my excitement and a thrumming anxiety concerning my surroundings. Although he must have been surprised to hear my voice, he picked up the tenor of the conversation immediately.
"Hey, what's happening?"
he said, just as casually, and I was reminded once again how good a case officer he really was. You know the woman we were talking about, Layla Kumali?
The cop?
Yeah. Well, her real name is Layla Al-Nusseri.
Sounds Arabic.
You're right. It was her in the phone box. There was dead silence at the other end. Despite Whisper's studied indifference, despite his years of experience and enormous talent, I had shocked the quiet voice out of him. I didn't know it then, but the effect of my words was amplified by the rolling failure of all our other efforts. The 100,000 agents working for a host of intelligence agencies, everyone supposedly looking for a man trying to build a dirty bomb, were delivering a lot of heat, but absolutely no light. Deep down, Whisper figured we were dealing with a clean skin, and that the chances of catching him in time were diminishing by the hour.
Oh yeah, in the phone box, huh?
He said, recovering his voice and making it sound as if it didn't mean much at all.
You sure about that?
No doubt. I met a guy who played an instrument, I won't try to pronounce it, made from the wing bone of an eagle. He showed me some footage.
Sounds weird,
Whisper said, sounding as if it was all pretty amusing.
How do you spell it? Al-Nusseri, not the eagle thing.
I told him, and in normal circumstances, the next question would have been about where I was calling from, but I was certain he already knew. Given his job, all calls to Whisper's cell phone were recorded, and I figured that he would have already scribbled a note to one of his assistants and had Echelon track the call. While he was waiting for the answer, I kept talking. There's something I feel strongly about, Dave. Very strongly indeed. You have to go softly. You should be careful who you talk to.
Why?
He replied.
You figure some folks will come up with a bright idea? They might want to move in and start hurting people?
Exactly. We assume she can contact him, but I'm pretty sure the system is booby-trapped.
A deliberate mistake under duress. Something like that.
Yeah. He thought about it for a few seconds.
I guess the guy would be foolish if it wasn't.
We could lose him totally.
I understand,
he said. There was another pause while he considered what to do.
I'm gonna have to run this past at least one other person. You with me?
He meant the president. Can you convince him to hold back? I said.
I should think so. He's an intelligent man. He'll get the problem. Can you nail this business down?
He asked. Find him? I've got a good chance, I replied. I heard a small sigh of relief. Or maybe it was just his blood pressure heading back down to Earth.
Okay, we'll assume we're going with the confidential thing. I'll get the researchers back onto her,
he said. You saw their previous efforts? I asked.
Sure. Not much good, was it?
Fucking hopeless. We've got to color outside the lines. Use other people.
Who?
Halfway across Turkey, following the white line from mile after mile until I was almost hypnotized, I'd been thinking about the CIA's research and how the hell to compensate for it. Somewhere just south of Istanbul, I decided what we had to do. Hay domo, I said to myself. There's someone I know, I said. I told him once that if I was in a corner and needed computer help, he'd be the guy I'd call. His name's Battle Boy.
Repeat that,
Whisper replied. Battle Boy.
That's what I thought you said.
It's with an I at the end, not a Y.
Oh, good. That makes a difference. Battle Boy with an I. It's almost normal, isn't it?
His real name's Lorenzo. That's his first name. He's been busted for stealing the details of 15 million credit cards. I heard Whisperer typing on a keyboard, obviously accessing an FBI database, and a moment later he was talking again.
Yeah, well, you're right about that. Jesus, the guy must be in the Hacker Hall of Fame. Anyway, 2 days ago, he cut a plea deal with the Manhattan DA.
What did he get?
15 years in Leavenworth.
15 years? I responded. I started cursing the people responsible. 15 years in the big house for credit cards? I wasn't sure he would survive it.
What was that?
Whisperer asked, overhearing my muttering. I said they're assholes. He always claimed they'd bleed him for all the information he had, then double-cross him.
I don't know anything about that.
I guess not, but you've got to keep him out, at least until we're finished. Tell him a friend of his, Jude Garrett, needs his help. I'll bet he'll outperform the other team no matter what resources they've got.
Battle Boy, for God's sake. Are you sure about this?
Of course I'm sure.
Okay, okay, he said. How do you want him to get in touch with you?
I don't know. If he can steal 15 million credit cards, I'm sure he'll find a way. We were finished with business, and suddenly I felt tired to the bone.
Before you go,
Whisper said, and his voice trailed off. I wondered if he had lost his train of thought, but it turned out he was finding it hard to say, that was all.
I told you once I envied you,
he continued, even quieter than usual.
Remember that?
Sure, in the car, I said.
I don't anymore. I'm just glad you're there, buddy. I don't think anyone else could have done it. It's been outstanding work. Congratulations.
Coming from Dave McKinley, it meant more than from anybody else in the world. Thanks, I said. After we hung up, I sat for a long time and thought. There was one thing I still couldn't fathom. Leila Al-Nusseri Kumali didn't fit any profile that I could imagine. Chapter 62. For the teenage boy in Elmina, the run of good luck that had started with the unexpected gift of a cell phone continued unabated. On a Wednesday afternoon, walking home from school, the phone rang, and he spoke to the man who had given it to him. The Saracen said that he was calling from Germany, where he had been lucky enough to find both a mosque that conducted itself in accordance with his strict beliefs, and a job that offered great promise for the future. The boy started to ask questions, probably with the thought that he might one day be able to join the father figure who had been so generous to him. But the Saracen cut him short by telling him that, unfortunately, he was heading to work, time was short, and he had to listen carefully.
Get the pen out. I'm going to give you an address.
While the boys sat on a wall under the shade of a tree and rummaged through his backpack, the Saracen explained that he had already posted him a key that would open the garage at his old apartment. Inside were the boxes of medical supplies he had spoken to him about. Remember, the expired vaccines with their official dispatch dockets already attached? Once the boy had received the key, he was to open the garage and fill in the following address.
Mark them to my attention, the Saracen told him, at Chiron Chemicals, in Karlsruhe, Germany. I'm going to spell it out, starting with the street address, okay?
Once he had finished and had made the boy repeat it back to him, he said that he had already organized for the Beirut courier, with a refrigerated truck, to visit the garage on Saturday morning. Could the boy be there to meet him and unlock the door? Of course he could. With that done, there remained only one more task. He told the boy to call the company in Beirut from which he had bought the industrial refrigerators and negotiate to sell them back.
Whatever money you get, you can keep, the Saracen said. That should guarantee you'll drive a hard bargain, he added, laughing.
When the Saracen told him what he could expect to receive for the items, the boy could hardly believe it. It was almost 6 months' salary for his mother, who worked in a local laundry. He tried to thank him, but the doctor cut him short, telling him that he had to run to get to work on time. The Saracen hung up, and though the boy didn't know it, it was the last time they would ever speak. The Saracen stepped out of a public phone box next to the Karlsruhe Market Square and sat for a moment on a wooden bench. It was close now. In a few days, the garage would be empty, and the 10,000 tiny bottles loaded onto a truck operated by a courier company which specialized in medical supplies. The boxes that contained the precious vials would be displaying genuine dispatch dockets from a Lebanese hospital, their destination well established as one of the largest producers of vaccines in the world, and all of them addressed to a man who was an authentic employee of the company's warehouse department. Chapter 63. The boxes arrived 5 days later. Their documentation showed that the courier had transported them to the port of Tripoli, where they had been loaded into a refrigerated container. A small Cedars Line freighter had taken them across the Mediterranean, and several days later, they had encountered European customs in Naples, Italy. How do I put this nicely? Italy, even at the best of times, isn't renowned for its thoroughness or bureaucratic efficiency. When the boxes arrived, it happened to be the worst of times. Continual budget cuts had taken a huge toll on the customs service, and its resources had been further depleted by a flood of containers carrying illegal immigrants risking the short journey from North Africa. Even though the boxes secretly contained a biosafety level 4 hot agent, none of them were open for inspection, let alone analysis. The overworked officers believed what the documentation and transit history attested to. They were expired vaccines being returned to the manufacturer in Germany. In Naples, the boxes were loaded onto a truck, driven north without any further inspection, crossed the unpatrolled border into Austria, and from there headed into Germany. They arrived at the Chiron Chemical Security Gate, just another shipment among the hundreds that went in and out every day, at 11:06 p.m., according to the guard's computerized log. One of them saw the contact number on the documentation. A guy working in the warehouse called him and said a delivery was on its way. The boom gate lifted. The driver was waved through, and 3 minutes later, the Saracen took possession of his 10,000 vials of liquid holocaust. The journey that had started so long ago with once classified information hemorrhaging online was almost at an end. The Saracen immediately stored the boxes in a rarely visited area of the warehouse reserved for discarded packaging and attached a sign in Turkish and German on the front of them. Do not move, awaiting further instruction. His original plan had been to sidetrack vials of a certain drug which was destined for the 40 largest cities in the United States, empty them of their contents, and replace with his own creation. It would have been a slow and dangerous process. On arrival at work on his first day, however, he had realized it wasn't necessary. The glass vials he had used in Lebanon were so close in appearance to those used by Chiron that even an expert eye would have been hard-pressed to tell the difference. All he needed to do was put labels on them. Immediately, he had started experimenting with solvents which would lift the labels off the legitimate drugs without damaging them. He needed the labels intact, and he found what he was looking for in a large art supply store, a common solution which neutralized most commercial glues. 10 half-gallon containers of it were already stored in his locker, and the only job that remained for him was to lift the labels off the genuine drugs and re-glue them to the tiny bottles of smallpox virus. They would then be shipped to America in perfect disguise, distributed to the 40 cities, and, he was confident, the U.S. healthcare system would do the rest. He was aware that changing the labels would be a long and laborious process, but, fortunately, he worked alone on the graveyard shift, and there was little real work to distract him. He had run it through in his head so many times, even spending one night timing himself, that he knew he would hit his deadline. There were 9 days to go. Chapter 64. After driving the 700 miles back, I arrived in Bodrum in the early afternoon, still trying to reconcile what I knew of Leila Kumali's life with her role in the imminent conflagration. I had stopped twice on the way for gas and coffee, and each time I had checked my phone and laptop, hoping for news from Battle Boy. But there was nothing, and the only email was 2 spam messages which had been filtered and gone straight to the junk folder. I was getting increasingly frustrated and worried. Maybe the samurai hacker wasn't going to be any better than the CIA. So when I saw the manager hurrying across the foyer towards me, I figured another disaster must have come down the pike. It turned out I was so tired I had misread the cues. He was hurrying because he couldn't believe I was back. I quickly realized that he had thought my story about visiting Bulgaria was bullshit, and that, having killed SpongeBob, I was gone for good.
"You are a person of the many great surprises," he said, shaking my hand warmly. "Perhaps all of the men of the FBI are just as you?"
"Handsome and intelligent," I said. "Nope. Just me." He clapped me on the back and spoke quietly.
"There has been nobody of the visit for you.
The newspapers say the man was of the robber type, probably for the drug using.
Relieved at that break, I thanked him and went to my room. Immediately, I checked my laptop for emails, but there was still nothing from Battle Boy, and I figured that, despite my fatigue, sleep would be impossible. Every few minutes, I would be looking to see if there was a message. Instead, I pulled out the files on Dodge's death that Kamali had given me and sat down at the desk. While I was waiting, I would see if I could find a trace of an American woman, one with a Midwestern accent. Chapter 65. I caught my first glimpse of her after 40 minutes. It was just a few words and a record of an interview, but it was enough. Kamali and her team had asked Dodge and Cameron's friends to recount how they knew the wealthy couple and to list the times they had spent together in Bodrum. It was standard stuff, the cops trying to build a picture of their lives, and thankfully, most of the transcripts were in English. Among them was one with a young guy called Nathaniel Clunies Ross, the scion of a hugely wealthy British banking dynasty who had known Dodge for years. He and his girlfriend had come down from Saint-Tropez to spend a week with Dodge and his new wife. There was nothing remarkable in that, apart from him being 26 and having $100 million boat to cruise around on, and I plowed through half a dozen pages as he catalogued the bankrupt lives of some seriously wealthy people. On the last page, he gave a brief account of a vodka-fueled night at a popular dance club called Club Zulu just along the coast. He said that six of them had flown in by chopper, and near the end of the evening, Cameron had run into a young woman called Ingrid, part of a larger party, who was a casual acquaintance. The two groups had ended up sitting together, and the most interesting thing, according to Clunies Ross, was that one of the guys in Ingrid's party, he couldn't recall his name, but he was pretty sure he was Italian and probably her boyfriend, had described his adventures with middle-aged vacationers.
"He ran a massage service on the beach," Clunies
Ross had explained. I started reading fast, the fatigue vanishing and my concentration roaring back. I sped through the rest of his interview, but could find no further mention of Gianfranco or, more importantly, of the woman called Ingrid. I turned to the back of the file and found the documents supporting the interview, including screen grabs from CCTV cameras at Club Zulu, grainy and distorted. The last of them showed a group of people, obviously pretty loaded, leaving the club. I saw Cameron and Dodge, a guy I figured was Clunies Ross with his girlfriend, all cleavage and legs, and right at the back, almost obscured, Gianfranco. He had his arm around an arresting woman, short-cropped hair, an even shorter skirt, tanned and lithe, one of those young women who seemed totally at ease in their own skin. By a quirk of circumstance, she was staring at the camera. She had large eyes, set a little deeper than you might have expected, and it gave the impression that she was looking straight through you. All my intuition, distilled and sharpened through countless hard missions and 1,000 sleepless nights, told me it was Ingrid. I turned and rummaged through the other files. Somewhere there was a master list, an index of all the names that had arisen during the investigation. There were scores of them, but there was only one Ingrid. Ingrid Cole. The index linked to the information the cops had assembled about her. I turned to Volume B, page 46, and saw that it was almost non-existent. She was such a no-account acquaintance, her interaction with Cameron and Dodge so minor that the cops hadn't even bothered talking to her. They did, however, take a copy of her passport. I looked at the photo in the book. It was the woman with the short-cropped hair at Club Zulu. Ingrid Cole. There was no interview, but some things were certain. She knew Cameron. She was a friend or something more intimate of Gianfranco's, and she was American. The passport said she came from Chicago, the heart of the Midwest. Chapter 66. I worked through other files, hoping to find another mention of her or more photos, but there was nothing. Just the one reference by the visiting banker and a poor-quality image from the surveillance camera. In the fading afternoon, I kept returning to it, and even though I took a long march through the attic of my memory, I couldn't recall anybody as attractive as Miss Cole. On a professional level, I kept trying to match a voice to the image and thinking about gardenias, When the computer beeped, telling me that I had mail, I figured it had to be Battle Boy, and I turned fast to the laptop, only to be disappointed. It was more spam, and it had also gone to the junk folder. Where the hell was the samurai? I asked myself in frustration, marking the crap messages for deletion. I saw they were for some prize-winning scam and hit the button to consign them to oblivion. Nothing happened. They were still there. I hit the button again, with the same result, and realized what a fool I had been. The messages, disguised as spam, were from Battle Boy. When I had first met him, and we were sitting in old Japan expunging Scott Murdoch's academic record, he had told me that he had recently designed a particularly nasty virus that looked identical to the countless spam messages circulating in cyberspace. It was so obvious that even the most primitive filter would recognize it and send it to the junk mail folder. When the unsuspecting owner, thinking that the filter had done its job, tried to delete the message, he would inadvertently activate it. Immediately, it would download a virus, a spyware Trojan or any other program Battle Boy deemed necessary. For instance, a keystroke logger to record credit card information. Having been busted by the feds, he had never got the chance to deploy his new spam bomb. Until now. And I knew that I had already downloaded the information he had discovered about Layla al-Nasuri Kumali. All I had to do was find it. I opened the first of the spam messages and was delighted to read that I was the lucky winner of an online sweepstake. In order to claim my winnings of $24,796,321.81, it was only necessary for me to send an email and they would reply with an authorization code and a list of instructions. The other spam emails were reminders, urging me not to delay and risk missing out on my windfall. I tried clicking on the payout button without the authorization, but nothing happened. I figured that what I was really looking for was an encryption code which would unlock a hidden file, and I was starting to wonder if Battle Boy was going to send it in a separate mail when I realized I already had it. I copied the numerals of my winnings, deleted the commas and dot, entered it as the authorization code and hit payout. It sure did. A document opened, and I saw a picture of Layla Kumali, aged about 16, taken from a driver's license. Underneath it was a list of everything Battle Boy had found out up to that point, and glancing through it, I saw that he had, exactly as I had hoped, certainly colored outside the lines. He said that he figured, as Kumali was a cop, that she had to be educated, and as a result, he had decided to try to track her through her schooling. The strategy gave him one huge advantage. It greatly reduced the number of people he was investigating. Shocking as it was, over 45% of Arab women couldn't read or write. He took 6 Arab nations and started searching middle and high schools. He found only one Layla al-Nasuri of the right age, in an online archive from a school in Bahrain where she had won an essay competition in English. He lost her for a while, but discovered that, in the Arabic language, Layla means born at night. And he started trawling through blogs and social networking sites using several dozen variations of that. Under the name Midnight, he unearthed a woman who had posted several items on a local blog about scuba diving in Bahrain. He managed to access their database and learned that Midnight was the online handle of Layla al-Nasuri, and it gave him an email address which she had been using back then. Figuring that she was over 17, and armed with her name and the email address, he tried to get into the Bahrain Department of Motor Vehicles in the hope that he could locate the details of a driver's license. It took him over 4 hours of brute force hacking, but he finally broke into their network and found her application. It provided the photo and also her date and place of birth. She had been born in Saudi Arabia. Battle Boy said that she faded away and he could find nothing more on her, not until 2 years later, when he located a photo and a précis of her academic career at a law college in Istanbul.
"That's all I have at the moment," he wrote.
I closed the pages and sat in quiet thought. I saw her again, approaching the phone box, speaking to a terrorist in the Hindu Kush, the most wanted man in the world. An Arab woman who got an education, went scuba diving, learned to drive, and traveled far away to attend college. Battle Boy had done a great job, but things were no clearer. Layla Kamali might have been born in Saudi, but it still didn't make any sense. Chapter 67. I walked. I hunched my shoulders, buried my hands in my pockets, and grappled once again with the contradictions of Kamali's life. I had left the hotel, wandered through a maze of small streets, and by the time I had tried 100 different ways to square the damn circle, I found myself at the beach. It was late afternoon and still warm, the last flicker of summer before autumn really blew in. I sat on a bench and looked across the foreign sea, turquoise and almost otherworldly in its brilliance. A father was splashing water with his 3 kids in the narrow zone where the water met the sand. Their laughter filled the air, and from there it was only a small step for me to start musing about a little boy who had no father to splash water with and didn't even know what Down syndrome was. The kid's mother walked close to take a photograph of her children, just as I was thinking about Kamali, and the quiet heartbreak she must have experienced when she saw the telltale single crease across the palm of her newborn baby's hand, and realized that he was the one in 700. The whole world seemed to slow. The glittering water from the kids' buckets hung suspended in the air. The father's laughing face barely seemed to move. The mother's hand froze on the shutter. My mind had run aground on a strange thought. Evidence is the name we give to what we have. But what about the things we haven't found? Sometimes the things that are missing are of far greater importance. In all the time I had spent searching Kamali's apartment, I hadn't seen one photo of her with the baby. There were none of her with him as a newborn on her desk, not one of her playing with him as a toddler, and no portraits on the wall. I hadn't found any in the drawers, and I had seen none in frames beside her bed. Why would you keep an album of photographs of a failed marriage and have nothing of you as a family, or of the little guy as a baby? Weren't they the things mothers always kept? Unless he wasn't her child. Still, the water hung in the air. The mother kept the camera to her face, and the father was caught in the middle of laughing. I wondered why I hadn't considered it before. She had arrived with her son in Bodrum 3 years previously, with her husband left far behind, and no friends or acquaintances to contradict her. She could have told people whatever story she wanted. And if he wasn't her child, whose was he? The water fell to the ground. The mother took her photograph. The father threw a splash of water back at his kids, and I started to run. It was dinner time, and I figured if I was fast enough, I could get to Kamali's house before she did the washing up. Chapter 68. Kamali opened the door wearing a casual shirt, a pair of jeans, and an oven mitt. As she wasn't expecting any visitors, she had dispensed with the scarf and tied her hair back in a ponytail. I have to say it suited her, accentuating her high cheekbones and large eyes, and I was struck again by how attractive she was. She didn't appear embarrassed about being seen with her hair uncovered and a shirt open at the throat, merely pissed off at being disturbed at home.
"What do you want?" she asked.
"Your help," I replied. "May I come in?"
"No, I'm busy. I'm just about to serve dinner."
I was ready to start arguing, to be as insistent as necessary, but I was saved the trouble. The little guy emerged from the kitchen, saw me, and started to run. Calling happily in Turkish, he came to a halt, gathered himself together, and gave a perfect bow. "Very good," I said, laughing.
"It ought to be. He's been practicing every day," Kamali said, her voice softening, pushing some wayward strands of the little guy's hair back into place.
"It'll only take a few minutes," I said, and after a pause she stepped back, letting me in. More for her son, if that's what he was, than from any desire to help me. I walked down the corridor ahead of them, making sure to look around, curious as if I had never been in the house before. The little guy was right behind, chatting away in Turkish, demanding that his mom translate.
"He wants to take you on a picnic," she said. "He saw a program on TV about an American boy. Apparently, that's what the best friends do."
I didn't joke. It meant everything to the child. A picnic? Of course, I said, stopping to bend down to him. Anytime you want. That's a promise.